Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our webinar Wednesday session. I'm Rick Stasloff, Senior Partner with RPK Group. I'm joined today by John McIntosh, Managing Partner at SeaChange. SeaChange helps nonprofits apply quantitative approaches to current challenges, including grant making, in support of mergers and sustained collaboration. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I can't wait for our topic today. Higher education's arrival at strategic partnerships. So John and I are going to get into some key ways to think about our question on the table. Why has higher education historically been reluctant to consider strategic partnerships? What are some of the common factors behind successful partnerships? And how might leadership begin a conversation around this topic? So let's jump in. Well, John, SeaChange has put a stake in the ground around supporting strategic partnerships. Can you talk to us a little bit about the role SeaChange has taken on and how that work is unfolding?
Yeah, I never thought we'd work in higher education. My joke used to be SeaChange is a real charity and we only work with real charities, no eds, no meds. And so although we had been a resource, to use your word, we put our stake in the ground back in 2008 to help sort of traditional not-for-profits explore, or if it made sense, complete mergers, joint ventures, acquisitions, deep partnerships. I never thought that it would be in higher ed. But institutions started to call. In fact, I just looked it up because I was interested. The first call we ever got was in late 2017. And then I got myself educated and realized that, you know, that there are a lot of schools out there and that some of them are going to face complicated times, and that maybe we should extend our work into higher ed. And so we did that a couple of years ago when we launched the Transformational Partnerships Fund, and as I'm sure we'll get into, I think higher ed thinks it's more different than it is. Many of the issues that you see in higher ed, we've seen for the last 15 years outside of higher ed, as we've been working with other not-for-profits, big and small, as they seek to explore various forms of partnerships that they think will better take their missions forward.
Yeah, I can't wait to get into some of this, particularly your thought of higher ed not being quite as unique as it thinks. Before we do that, you know, it's kind of curious, I think, that higher ed hasn't gotten here yet, and it takes entities like SeaChange, certainly RPK does this kind of work, you think about the work of Shio and others, to sort of help with the matchmaking, help normalize the conversation. I mean, one, I guess, do you think that's true, that it's critical to have third parties contributing to normalizing this in the current moment?
I mean, maybe. I think every institution needs help. I haven't seen very many situations where the institutions can do it completely on their own. I view us, and as you know, but just to reiterate, we're a completely philanthropic initiative. You know, we're a resource trying to help institutions that of their own volition have decided to explore something, help them by being a safe space for discussion, by being a source of referrals, by being a source of grants. I think in most cases, they do need help. Sometimes they need help figuring out what kind of help they need. But I view us as sort of a catalyst or an enzyme that, mm-hmm. that in most places there are voices within the institution, on the board or the president, that believe that change is necessary or at least worth exploring. And we just want to be their ally and help them do what nevertheless is very difficult work. I don't think outsiders can force it. I don't think that's their role, but I think they can be an ally to those on the inside that are trying to get things done. Because as we'll talk about more, although I don't think higher education partnerships are different in kind, I've never seen anything close up in my professional career that is as difficult as navigating an institution of higher education through the exploration or completion of a merger. Now, I've never been involved in brain surgery or rocket science or any of that stuff, but I think the degree of difficulty is very high but not because it's different in kind, just because there are so many constituents. That to me is what makes it complicated. So I think the role of outsiders is not to try to impose change on institutions, but to help those that want to change to make that easier in all sorts of ways.
Hmm. Lots to dig in there, especially around the whole messy human beings part of this. So our topic is higher ed's arrival, emphasis on arrival at strategic partnerships. You know, John, just before we got on, I saw headline flash up, merger just announced, Drexel, Salus University, graduate focused health sciences institution, 1,200 students, Drexel, 23,000. But, you know, not exactly a tsunami, but we're seeing more of these kind of deals announced. But let's talk about the arrival. What are you thinking? Has higher ed finally arrived at strategic partners as a thing we at least ought to be entertaining, if not moving towards? And if so, why?
Like, as I said, I've only been involved in higher education for 5 years. And so I don't know, you know, Franklin and Marshall merged in 1850, I think, maybe 1853. So I imagine it's true that if you did some sort of analysis of how many mergers and partnerships were there versus the number of institutions at the time, like, and I'm sure Parthenon or you or others have done that. You know, I'm not sure you would conclude that there was nothing and then suddenly it's arrived. I think what I would say is we certainly started to get phone calls 5 years ago. And since the two, to my mind, most important things that are driving discussions or driving the sense that, you know, the status quo is not ideal, or in some cases, maybe not even sustainable, our enrollment and technology. And we've known for 15 years or more what was coming from an enrollment perspective. You know, like, you know what the birth rate was, you know it went down in 2008 and has never come back, or only come back in COVID. So I think there probably is an increase and an uptick, but I don't think it's been a sea change, to excuse the pun, that people are suddenly thinking differently. I think that they're being buffeted by the same forces, and probably the more people explore these things, the easier it is, because, you know, you don't need to fight your board as doing this unusual thing. Just the opposite. You can sort of say, like, everybody's doing it. It would be derelict for us not to be at least open to the possibility that perhaps the best way forward is some sort of partnership. So maybe that's new, but I don't see it as all or nothing. But again, I haven't been around long enough. I think it's just a response to these trends, because last thing I'd say is, outside of higher ed and even in the corporate world, it's very seldom that institutions do a hard thing like explore a merger just for the hell of it, where you have two institutions that say, things are fine as far as the eye can see. But you know what? Lord, who made us both great, make us greater still. Let's, even though both of us are just fine as far as the eye can see, let's explore coming together. I wish there were more of that, but there isn't. And that's not unique to higher ed. There just isn't. So usually there's got to be something going on in the background. And again, I think for many institutions, technology and enrollment and other things we can talk about, the preferences that young people have in terms of what they want to study, are all forcing schools to recognize that things are probably not great if they look out far enough. And so the time to start thinking about that is now, rather than waiting too long.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you in that. If you were just to look at the numbers, I don't think you'd say we've arrived, because it's very few, quite frankly, you know, and I continue to be a voice that says, I don't think we're going to see in this moment the kind of tsunami, right, you know, where 20%, 30% of institutions are going to close or have to merge. That said, I do anticipate over the coming years, we will see an uptick in the numbers. I mean, I think for me, arrival points back to something that you said, which is more of the normalization, right? It's now an okay conversation to have. Maybe even to push that a step further, it's a required conversation, meaning if you're a board, you're expecting your senior team to be having these conversations, not presuming where they go. But it's something that we don't just talk about, you know, when we're near the end of life, right? So that normalization, I think, helps us then in terms of more institutions engaging. I think the other piece that's shifting is that institutions are seeing it's not bifurcated, meaning strategic partnership used to mean I either continue doing what I'm doing the way I'm doing, or I merge and cease to exist, and are now realizing there's this whole continuum of creating consortial activities around academic programs or around administrative services. There are opportunities to come together and create new legal entities. There are ways to share assets. There are ways, yes, we may move towards a more traditional understanding of mergers, meaning there's more options on the table, and it's more and more an okay, perhaps even an expected thing to talk about. So that's where I see some of the biggest shifts.
That's right.
And when you think about why that's happening, I think you've named a number of them already in terms of pressures from enrollment, financial issues. I think that a particular driver in the present moment is more and more institutions are trying to get their FY24 budgets together, and it's just not working, right? These gaps are persisting. When you think about the fact that the HRF funding, the federal funding, has all been consumed, so we can't fill those holes anymore, I think it pushes you to have to start to think differently in terms of how we're going to bring this mission forward in some new ways. So I think that gets into the idea. You talked about the role that outside groups can play, but let's talk about this kind of external pressure piece. What's your insight or your thinking about whether institutions of their own accord will increasingly move towards strategic partnerships if they need to? Or do they need some kind of nudging or pressure?
I think that the underlying energy source for many of these discussions needs to be, you know, what's best for the mission. But that's a kind of abstract, woolly thing. What is this mission exactly? Mm-hmm. And I think in most cases, that collapses first and foremost to what's the best thing for students, which is not at all to deny that faculty and other employees, and in many cases, the local community, because many institutions are college towns and they're the college, aren't important. But I think most of the discussions I've seen, there is some group on the board and in the leadership who says, listen, continuing as we are isn't likely to be the right thing for students. And obviously, in the catastrophic case, and there's been research that's come out from the National Student Clearinghouse, you know, If continuing as we are is an abrupt closure, that's obviously a terrible result for students, and particularly for first-generation college goers, students from low-income backgrounds, students of color who've been told, work hard, go to college. It's the best thing you can do for your life chances, economic and otherwise. And for those kids to be stranded in a bad closure is just a moral foul. And I think short of that, there's, well, a good closure, which might be the best option. But even short of that, I think, you know, being in institutions that are so consumed with what I'll call mere survival, that those young people don't get the bargain that they deserve. So I think that's what needs to drive these discussions. I think what you've seen in things like the Financial Stability in Higher Education Act in Massachusetts and others is just try to make a little bit clearer how one might think about that. That if you can't graduate your juniors, that's probably like a bright line. If you can't, like, so I don't think the outside pressure is going to be successful in forcing institutions to take action. Or if it does, it's going to force them when it's far too late, when they're on heightened cash monitoring or whatever. But I think it can help define what do you mean by, you know, we're running out of degree freedoms. What do you mean by treating students well? I think we can help sort of set some commonly understood sort of definitions for things which will then be easier for boards and others to chew on. And like, to me, again, I think the Financial Stability Act was pretty good. I think it says, you know, if you can't graduate the people who are entering third year, you need to come talk to us. And that's, I think that's been helpful in New England, in Massachusetts. I think that's been helpful in forcing the conversation and not having institutions move the goalposts and say, well, as long as we can get through the semester, it's okay. And maybe there's a role for things like, you know, for things like that.
Yeah, you know, from my perspective, I've actually seen a real benefit to the external pressure. Legislature saying, we're going to take a hard look at this and we need to do it by a certain date. So I think about, for instance, the role the legislature played in Vermont in kind of pushing the conversation for the consolidation of the four-year state institutions and putting some reward structures out there at the same time.
You know, you're right. I was speaking more of the privates. I think the publics, it's a different analysis for sure.
And even on the private side, I mean, I've seen boards really stepping up in their oversight role to say, not we will enter a strategic partnership, but we need to have this conversation. We should be looking at this. So we think about ways to, yes, drive down costs, but more importantly, as you say, serve students, serve the mission under some new models. I found board voices have been really critical, quite frankly, not just in putting the question on the table, but also in terms of the pace, meaning not whenever you're ready, have this conversation, but we need to have this conversation and we need to draw some conclusions from that and figure out what next steps are by this point in time. So I think that's actually been helpful nudging, or even more than a nudge, some pushes for higher education. My hope is that over time, we'll start to see some more use cases, John. And you know, another observation I have about higher ed is it tends to be the case that institutions, systems, et cetera, want to see what others have done. And when you have a win, then they go, oh, look what they did over there. I bet we could do that. Let's try that. Let's go talk to them, right? It normalizes it. And you now see a roadmap that you can start to follow. Right now, even when you have leadership that says, I don't think we can keep doing what we're doing the way we're doing it, it's not clear what we would do instead. So we need more of those wins.
Right. I agree with that completely. I would highlight a couple of things that are perfect examples of that. I think the Martin Methodist Bloomfield College examples are often cited in other places where perhaps there's going to be an arrangement that bridges the public-private divide. Or often where the system is considering whether, for whatever set of reasons, it might usefully absorb or support in some way a private. And everybody goes back to those two examples because they're in people's minds, for sure. I think the other thing we need to try to find a way to do is, is celebrate success. Mm-hmm. You know, I send them around because I think it focuses the mind. If you read the Attorney General's note to the board members of Mount Ida, that's bracing reading. Basically says, if you had any money, we'd sue you. You were derelict in your duty. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but that's basically what it says. And in New York, the Attorney General's finding about Cooper Union, same thing. Basically, I mean, it's staggering reading. It basically says, you were asleep. You didn't ask any questions. You didn't do any realistic contingency planning. So we have examples where things have gone wrong, but we need to find and celebrate examples where people have done things right. And that's hard because there is this feeling that any meaningful change to the status quo is, quote, the end of the institution.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think in some ways, from some perspectives, maybe there is a point of view where Mills College is no longer exists, but there are other perspectives where it continues to exist. Thank you very much. And ditto for a wheel lock. Take the College of New Rochelle, which was a disaster and a fraud and this and that, but their biggest program was nursing. If you talk to the nursing students, it was wildly successful. They did a teach out with mercy. Many of the faculty went. So I think we need to be careful about what biases we bring when we're looking at some of these things, and celebrate and find ways to discuss and explore and share things that have gone well. Because we don't just want to have bad examples. And I think we've been involved in things. I think the Southern New Hampshire urban transaction, I think the Madeira Trochai transaction, from what I can see, should be celebrated as reasonably good decisions in light of the circumstances. And there are arrangements that I think will stand the test of time from the perspective of students, which is the most important thing, at least from where I sit.
Well, there's certainly an element, right, of it's not about you, right? Meaning it's about who you're serving. It's about bringing the mission forward in the best way. And struggling to survive is really not a recipe for bringing the mission forward in that regard. So,
the other thing I would say, if I can just jump in, is, you know, it's really hard. I mean, my rough count is there's 10 constituents that matter to some degree. The alumni, the faculty, and let's split contract from tenure, maybe the local community, the board, the accreditor, the AG, state ed, and the feds. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I think there's a sort of, I don't know, I just think it's inhuman, or it's just not realistic, where people judge institutions for not, quote unquote, doing the right thing or not doing it as quickly as they should have, without a lot of sympathy for how hard it is. And I don't know, I've never been the trustee of a struggling institution. And if I were a trustee of my alma mater and it was struggling, am I sure sitting here right now that I would do the right thing, that I would look reality in the face and make those hard, tough-minded decisions? I can't say that. So I think it goes back to there's a role for outsiders, there's a role for help, but we also kind of need, I think, to say, this is hard and let's help you do it, but not judge people for not sort of doing what they should be doing, because who amongst us knows whether we would really do everything right? I think there's a lot of sort of, again, arrogance and callousness from the outside, where we're judging the institutions for not doing what they obviously should have done. And that's just not very charitable. And I also don't think it encourages good action. Nobody, very few people can be shamed into taking action, at least in my experience.
So I think this gets us to a great next question, which is, well, what does get in the way? I love, you know, the language you're using around what's the space we want to create? How can we assume goodwill, right? But clearly things get in the way. What kind of things are you experiencing in your own work that are getting in the way, and what do we do about it?
I mean, I think the biggest single thing that gets in the way is time. Mm. In two ways. Most institutions are short-staffed right now. So just who are the people that are going to take the time out of their already busy days to explore this partnership, to figure it out? So there's that element of time. But I think there's just a great temptation to start these things too late. And I think it goes back to all the various constituents. And you look at, I'm looking at the Inside Higher Ed President Survey, and let's just say these are directionally correct. More than half of presidents agree that they need shared governance that allows for speedier decision-making. Almost 20% agree that trustees do not understand the challenges facing their institution, right? And so starting early enough that you have the time to bring your trustees up to speed about what's going on, to really understand your strengths and your needs, starting early enough that you can work through whatever your interpretation of shared governance is in whatever way you think is appropriate, right? If you don't start early enough, you just run out of time. So in most cases where we've seen institutions really struggle, it's because they started too late. And my sort of walking around number would be, you should be starting, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years before you believe things might get tough. And I think a lot of institutions, as you said, or at least a few, see the HERF money drying up. They see that enrollment hasn't responded the way they might have hoped, and they don't have 3 or 4 years. And it's pretty hard to explore these things if you don't have that kind of time, particularly since you can't presume that an exploration is successful. Maybe it turns out that that's not a good match, or there's nothing to do, and you need to start early enough that you can say, oh, okay, the conversation with so-and-so didn't go anywhere. What did we learn? What do we do next? And I think you have institutions that have effectively all their eggs in one basket.
Yeah, I think I often say to people, John, the number one sin in this whole conversation is not starting soon enough, you know, and because of what it takes to unfold. And also because as institutions get closer to the point of having to, of course, it means they have fewer assets on the table. You know, they have less resource. They actually become a less attractive partner as they move closer and closer to that line versus.
And the communication challenge gets more difficult.
Yep.
Right. I mean, I think nothing gets easier, but I feel like some trustees particularly are totally on board with not starting too late. They just don't know when too late begins because again, the process of getting something like a merger approved with all the various requirements for approval, it's a long time. You know, you look Bloomfield Montclair, all in the public domain. They made the announcement and it's going to be close to 2 years before that closed at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Procare Medi, again, also in the public domain, at least 18 months. So even just that, the once you've decided you're going to do it, getting everything filed and all approved, if that's 18 months, then you should be starting these discussions, you know, a good chunk of time before that. And I think that's, again, that goes back to that's really hard to do because there'll always be a voice that says, we don't need to do this. And if you wait till everybody agrees, oh, yes, we do, it can often be, you know, very difficult to explore anything. In my experience.
Absolutely. I also think it gets back to the mission and carrying it forward. But this idea that a strategic partnership is somehow a failure, like you only do it because you have to, because you have no other option or choice, right? Rather than seeing it as another tool in the toolbox for us to bring our institution and our mission forward in new ways. And that's requires then we get boards in a different place, we get senior leadership in a different place, really we get our communities in a different place. I think back to normalizing that conversation to me feels essential.
I think the other thing that on that is, and it's an abstract argument, but it happens to be true. The duty of a board, at least of a not-for-profit, is to the mission of the organization, the mission that the institution was established to pursue. It's not to the institution itself, mm-hmm. or the institution in its current form. And I'm not saying that we're all Vulcans and can do this, but if the best way to take your mission forward is actually, I don't know, to sell your real estate and become a foundation and make grants instead of doing residential school, not only would your duty allow you to do that, one could argue it mandates it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just remembering that, yes, there's a great pull from nostalgia and I remember the great class of 1989 and all that stuff, but my duty is to the mission of the organization, not its continuation in any particular form. And just reiterating that, reminding yourself of that and putting students first. I think that's, you know, that's the best shot groups can have to create enough enthusiasm and energy that they can fight through all the tough stuff. And there's always tough stuff, always. It's never easy.
Yep. Well, I love the way you frame that in terms of shifting. What's my job? I always think about that when I'm at the table, wherever it is. What's my job here? Candidly, I don't hear a lot of institutions use that kind of language, right? It really is focused on the institution and the perpetuation of the institution and the growth of the institution. So it would really shift the job, I think, in a good way, quite frankly, in terms of what are we supposed to be about here, to start to come at it more from that mission and student first perspective.
Yeah, the other thing I would just add is I also think that most institutions rightly believe that they have strengths, that there's something, well, more than one thing, but there's something that they're really good at that's core to their mission. And it might just be being in a particular place, in a place where, you know, otherwise it's an education desert. It might be a particular program. It might be a demonstrated track record serving a certain population of students. And so I think that you know, even for those institutions which overall feel financially under pressure, you're only going to keep your chin up and be excited if you sincerely believe that there's something here that's important to preserve and maintain, which is different, I think, than maintaining the institution in its traditional format taken as a whole. But I think most people need to find that something. And in my experience, most people have it. There's something that they really believe, you know, the core of our school is blank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in things like Mills, again, just from the outside, sometimes the most fractious discussions have been where one group of people thinks the core to our school is we were only women. And someone else says, no, that wasn't core. And so they see a transaction that violated what they saw as the strengths, and others viewed it differently. You know, that's why it's a pluralistic world and we can disagree.
So I want to come back to something you said early in our conversation this afternoon, that higher ed's not quite as unique as it might think. Talk to me a little bit about that in terms of how does that become a positive, right? In terms of how we can shift thinking and move forward.
Yeah, look, when people started to call and they asked us to get involved in higher ed, I said no. For lots of reasons. Part of it was just ignorance. I didn't understand. I grew up in Canada and I didn't understand the structure of higher education here because at the time my kids hadn't really been through it. But part of it was a sincere belief that even though we'd looked at over 1,000 partnerships over, you know, at that time, I guess 12 or 13 years, I didn't really think we'd learned anything outside of higher education that would be relevant inside higher education. It seemed like a different world. And obviously, there's a bunch of jargon you need to learn. I mean, most normal human beings don't know what an accreditor is, and most normal human beings don't know what shared governance means, and most normal human beings don't know what the triad is. Like, so there's a little bit of complexity at first blush, but once you get over that, and that takes, I don't know, an afternoon or maybe a week at the outside, you just call people like you and pick their brains and say, what the hell is an accreditor anyway? What is this IPEDS thing? I think then you realize that the people are no different than the people outside of higher ed, that people are concerned about jobs. They're concerned about doing the right thing. They don't always spend the time on task. They should, that different people take different points of view because of where they sit. The mayor of the town is unlikely to see things quite the same way as the provost or whatever. And so it's just that the complexity is just there are more constituents, but the individual issues, the things that people think about and face and struggle with are no different than outside of higher education, I think it takes more time because there's more constituents. But there's nothing, in my view, magical that makes the individuals in higher ed more resistant to change, the individuals in higher ed less likely to face reality. I think the complexity just comes because most corporations or most not-for-profits don't have the same number of stakeholders, that a higher education institution does, but I don't think the issues that are raised are any different. I really don't.
Interesting.
And so I think there's this great desire to make it more complicated than it is. You know, we're asked so many times, do you have a taxonomy of partnerships? You know, everybody has this image where, I don't know, merger, teach out, acquisition, co-curricular, whatever. Mm-hmm. And my answer is absolutely not. Do you really think a taxonomy matters? Like, how someone classifies what you do with another institution after the fact is irrelevant. The most important thing is, do you have the will and the courage and the bravery, the courage to sit down with another institution and say, here's what we think we're really good at. Here's where we're struggling. Here's what we need. Hey, what have you got? What might you do? And the taxonomy doesn't come into that. If I called you up for lunch and said, I'd like to explore a co-curricular shared service back office agreement, you'd say, what? Why don't we just have lunch and talk about, like, you know, what's going on in the world? And so I think just taking that first step, mm-hmm. Is the most important thing, and making sure that as background to that first step, the board, senior leadership, and maybe even in some cases the faculty have enough background understanding about where the institution really is that they're likely to be supportive if you come back from that dinner and say, hey, there might actually be something to do here, right? It doesn't require a taxonomy, and there's nothing magical about it for higher ed. That's the way deals work in all the industries that I've been part of. It just takes longer because there are more stakeholders who look at things in a slightly different way, in my view.
So I know, you know, we don't want to admire the problem. You know, there's plenty of challenges in higher ed. You know, what would you say, what are you saying to institutional leaders that are calling you and saying, hey, I want to move in this direction, at least as an exploration? Like, what needs to be true to start moving in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, we do the work and we recommend the grants, but the four funders in our fund ultimately have the decision-making power: ECMC, Kresge, Dell, and Ascendium. And I think that what we really need to be interested to support a particular situation is nothing more, when it comes right down to it, than a belief that the leadership, both presidential and at the board, is honest about where they are and is entering into the discussions in good faith. And whether those discussions, and we've supported all these things, are, can we do a pretty narrow partnership to jointly staff our institutional research function because we're all struggling, through to a back office agreement starting with IT, through to a full-on merger. Like, all those things in my mind start with, is the leadership aware of where they are, and are they going into this in good faith? And we've made lots of small sort of secret grants just, you know, just to fund a very early exploratory conversation, a handful of people from both institutions going off to a quiet hotel somewhere, just to see whether they can get to trust one another, just to begin to explore what's possible, you know, through to larger grants to try to help the whole thing happen. But again, I think it starts with, you know, is there an understanding of where you sit? Is there a good faith openness to trying to figure it out? Because there's no point in funding the exploration of something which one or more boards then says, no, we're never going to do that. And then finally, does it seem like there's enough time? You know, if someone says, we our projections show us running out of cash in 6 months, we would never support them in exploring something, because you're just the clock's going to run out. It just is. Mm-hmm. But when people have a couple of years, when they seem to be honest about where they are and when they're going into it in good faith, at the end of the day, that's what we're looking for.
Well,
those things are hard, right?
Yeah,
like going into it.
Question.
I'm going to say it's easy to say, it's hard to do.
Yeah, getting started. And I also think your emphasis on keep it simple at the outset, particularly, you know, I'm a big fan of sort of go, no go moments. And a lot of times I think institutions think they have to have it all figured out and then engage, you know, and to say, no, just start with what would ideal partner look like? What would I need, you know, in terms of how it fills in certain gaps that I have? What do I bring to the table? Oh, let's have that conversation. Does the fit feel right? Okay, let's take the next step now. You know, it's so that you don't have to go right into that deep dive into all the due diligence, right?
Totally.
Day one.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people waste a lot of time and money doing detailed work and then discovering that they're not going to go forward for reasons that they should have known much easier, much early.
Yeah.
And some, you know, and our process is to try to respectfully call the question, you know, respectfully say, oh, like, okay, you seem really keen, but like, where is the board taken as a whole? You know, are there different factions? Or to say, look, we can't prove it exactly, but my sense is that your partner here is going to need some money between now and when you get all the approvals. Is that, you know, collateralized by, again, and this is in the public domain, you saw that with Bloomfield Montclair, mm-hmm. collateralized by real estate or whatever it is, could you imagine providing that financial support prior to the partnership getting all the requisite approvals? And there's no right answer to that question. Some would say, absolutely, sure. Others would say, we're not a bank. But you might, you know, you want to raise those big issues up front, because the real tragedy, I don't think partnerships are always the answer, far from it. But the real tragedy is to spend 6 months and a bunch of money exploring something that didn't happen for reasons you could have known, because as a minimum, you've wasted 6 months as a bunch of money, but maybe you only had 12 months. So it's not just 6 months you've wasted, you've wasted half your available time. And as importantly, you can poison the well for the next conversation that someone may quite reasonably say, you know, why are you wasting time on this again? Don't you remember what happened? We got left at the altar in 2022. And so really thinking hard about what are the big issues likely to be here? And can we figure it out up front? Can we organize the process to do that? We made a grant, this is in public domain, to pay per diems for faculty to work outside of their normal contract hours to see if they could work together at a very granular program level, because the feeling was the merger would only make sense if you could get deep programmatic alignment. So let's start with the program that we think would be the most easily aligned, because if we can't get that to work, there's no point in thinking about receivables and real estate and boards, right? So I don't think there's an answer to what exactly should you be looking at up front. What exactly is the big issue? It's going to differ case by case, but there's really no reason to spend money on lawyers and accountants looking at the nonsense until you've made some progress on the big things.
Absolutely. You know, I always think there's just a couple key questions on the front end. Where are we right now? Be brutally honest with yourself. Where are you trying to get to? And to get there, do you think you need a strategic partner? Yes or no? If you think you do, what kind of partner do you think you're looking for? Now you can be proactive, right? And start reaching out to engage in that conversation well before we get into all the other deep dives, etc. And very often we have institutions call us and say something like, hey, I got a call from ABC University. They want to enter into a strategic partner. Should we do that? And I always try to bring them back to put that aside for a minute. That's the deal at the moment. But where are you? Where are you trying to get to? Do you even want to think about a strategic partnership? Now we can intelligently think about that strategic partner. But first things first.
Right.
Well, then let's think about, John, as you know, we drive towards, you know, our own finish line today. You know, where do we go from here? You know, what's your thought about how this conversation can best unfold around strategic partnerships?
I mean, it's funny. I've had calls from a couple of board members of strong institutions. Or who knows whether they're really strong, but the board members think they're strong. Mm-hmm. And they basically say, God damn it. You know, I want to grow through M&A, but we haven't done a single deal yet. You know, what's going wrong? These are like business types. And obviously they're crazy. And I tell them that. I say, listen, you have in your mind that Google's done 150 plus acquisition in its life and Microsoft's done 200 and Facebook. That is not, you know, if you really shoot the lights out, I don't know, you're Northeastern or whatever, maybe you'll do like three or four. Mm-hmm. Most people who want to grow through acquisition will do zero. Why don't you just try to find one good partnership and take it from there, right? So I think there's this mindset amongst certain trustees of stronger schools and maybe amongst certain commentators that there's going to be just an explosion of M&A or closures. And I don't see it. I think where we go from here is individual institutions being honest about where they are, what they have, what they need, and recognizing that in some cases, partnerships may be worth exploring and may be the right answer. In other cases, it may be to reduce cost or grow a new program or close down, whatever it is. And that we'll look back, I hope, in 10 years, and the structure of higher education will have changed quite a bit, but there'll never be a moment where you say there was a huge wave, there was a huge change. I just don't think, and we don't have a system that really has a top-down direction, right? There's really not really a federal system. So there's nobody who can make a choice that suddenly drives all this action. Again, I think it has to be bottom up at the state level for the publics, at the individual institution level, supported by people like you or me or whatever. And again, I think we'll look back and we'll say, I hope we'll say, you know, institutions did transform. They did, a lot of them made wise choices. Not all of them. Some of them kept their heads in the sand and didn't. But there was quite a remarkable transformation over a period of a decade, even though there was never a moment where you said, aha, it's happening. I just don't see that aha moment. And all we can do is help the institutions that reach out and help to normalize the conversation. And that's, you know, that's it. Celebrate success.
Yeah. Creating that space to me seems essential in normalizing it, just as you said. I mean, for myself, I agree with you. I don't think we'll see a tidal wave. I do think we're going to see a steady increase over time, 3 to 5 years, definitely. And it'll be, as I said, another tool in the toolbox. And that'll look different, you're right, for different institutions. You know, a lot of interest right now in administrative service consortiums. I think that's great. Generally, that's a focus on cost savings, right? For cost savings, for some institutions, that might get you there, but probably not. If we really want to start to move more towards mission fulfillment, solving for questions around quite frankly, value proposition, probably you're going to have to push a little bit harder, I think, to be more directly responding to the market, helping students get to the finish line, helping students connect to the world of work. So I'm going to be really interested when we have this conversation 3 to 5 years from now in terms of the look back. And do we see a jump up and plateauing? Do we see a steady rise? What does it mean in terms of how we've come to address overcapacity right now in the industry? So,
yeah. And I think last thing I would say there is, you know, I think people don't realize, you know, there's only 3,200 schools, excluding the for-profits, which is a trivial number when you think of how many not-for-profits or corporations there are, right? But there's a huge amount of skew in terms of where they are and how big they are. And so, you know, how it may be that there's been a lot of transformation in terms of the number of institutions that have done new and different things, even though in aggregate, it hasn't sort of changed very much because many of those institutions are in the, you know, the two thirds that are under 1500 students, as I recall the math, something like that. And so that's why I'm sort of suspicious that if I'm a board chair or if I'm a president, I shouldn't spend too much time thinking about what's going on in higher education more broadly. I should be thinking about what programs do we have that are good? Where are we struggling? Where, if at all, could we reduce our costs? How are we thinking about our real estate? What sort of projection should we make about enrollment? And what's going on in the system of higher education is sort of background noise that is best ignored unless I have a rhetorical purpose in talking about it to get my board to recognize that some of the things we're struggling with, others are struggling with too. Because it's such a heterogeneous community that I think anything that's true of higher education broadly is not necessarily true of individual institutions, which is where all the action is.
Well, I think those are some good words to end on, John. And I'm a big believer in focusing on controlling the things you control. So what are we good at? What do people need? How do we bring more of those things together and move forward there? So I want to thank you, John, for your insights and certainly for the work you and the team at SeaChange are doing around normalizing this conversation. And I want to thank everybody for joining us today out there in higher ed. Keep doing the good work you're doing. And please join us in the months ahead as we get into more topics through our webinar Wednesday series. Take care, everybody.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.